given up that the upper setting for your magic machine is infinite, but is there something in the basic laws of nature that loathe and despise infinities that is going to come crushing down on you as you turn the dial up, and what might that be?
I don't know. That's a very good question. Perhaps so. I'll keep listening into that. 82 OGB.
Okay, I'm glad you think it's interesting. I hope other people think it's interesting. Anyone want to roll it around in their mind and talk about it on the radio?
KZ2WOT.
And WS1.
Yes, WOT, Paul recognized as well.
Is it mine, KZ2WOT?
Yes, Chris.
So, the photon is a massless particle, isn't it?
It's a rest massless particle.
So, having no mass, then I think an infinite number could occupy the same space.
Okay, but you also have to consider that gravitational field affects light. You have the black hole producing a lensing effect on stars and such. So it does interact with gravity.
Photon can only interact with any other photon apart from himself.
Okay, Wes recognized. We'll get to you, Wes. Paul?
I would say the space that the frequencies are occupying. So if the space goes down to such a small number, whatever frequencies are in there won't have enough room to exist. The distance between the 0 point and the 360 point, that won't happen if the distance is reduced to such a point that those frequencies won't work. Is that what you mean?
Well, I'm just asking a kind of intellectual exercise to theorize what happens if you have a constant frequency. So you don't have to worry about the energy levels being different. They're all the same energy level. It's just you're just changing the luminosity. Is there anything in the nature of space-time that really hates an infinite amount of photons occupying the same space? Now, due to the Pauli exclusion principle that I mentioned earlier, there's nothing in quantum mechanics per se that would disallow an infinite number of photons to exist in the same space, but, Mother Nature is a little weird, and there are theories that get in to it and dispute that you can do this infinitely. And I just thought it would be interesting if people kind of rolled that concept around and thought of what might be theoretically possible with an almost infinite amount of photons in one spot in space, and how could it screw up the laws of physics?
KD2DK.
Yes, John.
Roy, that is a really, really interesting question. An infinite number of photons at a fixed frequency, that would imply an infinite amount of energy, right? Unless they're at rest, at which, they have no energy. But it's interesting that you draw the correlation between gravity from a black hole being able to affect a photon, and you certainly are correct that a photon has zero mass, being a massless particle when at rest. The interesting thing comes in is the relativistic effects, is that a photon does actually gain mass as it increases in speed. So it's an interesting thing that you've got me thinking about, is if you have a photon, say, at the event horizon of a black hole, and it has zero velocity, will it get sucked into the black hole versus his buddy who is traveling along at the speed of light? Interesting thing for me to think about. Back to you.
Okay, very good. I just want to clear up, if a photon did not have a zero rest mass, when it traveled at the speed of light, due to relativity, it would have an infinite mass, effectively. So at rest, it has no mass, which is a zero rest mass. When it's traveling, that's a question of what exactly is going on with it. So that's something to consider as well. You, unfortunately, with photons, you might use basically the fact that photons have energy. Energy and mass are sort of different forms of the same thing, equals mc squared. So anything that has energy has mass. Anything that has mass has energy. Except, again, you got to keep in mind that the weirdness of photons are that they have no mass at rest. So that's why I keep on calling it rest mass.
KP2, GSM?
Yes, GSM.
I am constrained to point out that there is no such thing as photon rest mass, because there is no such thing as a photon at rest. It is a massless particle. It has one speed, which is the speed we call the speed of light. But if you slow it down, well, you just can't do that.
Well, you can stop it, and once you stop it, it ceases to exist. So that's what kind of people mean when they say rest mass. If you take a photon and you stop it, it ceases to exist, and something that doesn't exist has zero mass.
KP2, GSM again. You cannot stop the photon. You can absorb it, in which case the thing that absorbs it gains energy somehow. For example, an electron jumps a level, and so on. But that, as you mentioned, means the photon ceases to exist and the energy reappears as in the electron that it has bumped.
Yes, I totally agree. You cannot create or destroy mass energy. You can only convert it from one form to another and move it from one place to another, and that usually requires work. So I agree with you, but I think we're kind of falling into semantic arguments that photons, photons don't just disappear and leave no trail. They simply transfer their energy to something else. But just the concept of a photon ceases to exist when it transfers its energy someplace else, and there's no residual mass around because it didn't have any rest mass to shift to something else.
I have a problem with your question.
Okay, Wesley, what's your problem with my question?
Photon cannot interact with another photon. Photon can only interact with itself. The second thing is, you were talking about slight change in intensity. Slight change in intensity of the photon is change of energy of the photon. And that has a reason of it. And reason for it. Something made it happen. So, you said then we have ultimate infinite photon. Are we talking about having a lot of photons, and then the number of photons is exceeding the speed of light? I mean, never exceeds speed of light, but the number of photons is bigger than the number that is representing speed of light. Is that the question is not clear, it's convoluted. Enter again.
Well, AC2GS, by the way, I'm sorry if it sounds convoluted. It sounded somewhat convoluted when you were trying to explain it back to me. I'm not saying that you're changing the frequency of the photons. The photons are remaining exactly at the energy level and the frequency of a red light. What you are doing is increasing the luminosity, the lumen count, the number of photons in a very, very small space in the middle of space. So you're not increasing the individual energy level of each photon. You're just increasing the number of photons which are being forced to coexist in a very, 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 very small area. That's what you're doing. So the question is there something about light, photons, electromagnetism, space-time that throws a wrench into a practically infinite number of photons of the same energy squeezed together? And I do agree that you would reach an endpoint of impossibility at the infinity point, because an infinite number of photons would require an infinite amount of energy, and so it breaks the system. So as a little hint, it gets broken long before you run out of energy in this magical machine.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Just I guess no reason, but would you be creating a black hole at some point?
Give that man a gold star? Do you know the name for that? There is an actual name for that.
No, I don't. It was just intuition.
Okay. It is one of the nicest names I've ever heard. I have mentioned it on the technical net before, but a long time ago. It is called a Kugelblitz. A Kugelblitz is a theoretical phenomenon where the effective mass of a large number of photons is sufficient to cause a gravitational distortion where space-time curves in on itself and produces an effectively a black hole. Anyone want to comment about my Kugelblitz? You can Google it. It's Googleable.
AD2DK makes perfect sense. I'm wondering if I can get an amplifier for my rig here that can output an infinite number of photons and put it in a very, very small space.
For many of these Gedanken experiment theoretical magical machines, I would like every single one of those magical machines, except for the one that produces microscopic black holes. I don't think that would be terribly fun, personally.
Interesting. But it's not the amplifier. You're operating on red light frequency. And that would be the amplifier that amplifies the red light. Interesting. Okay. That's my comment.
Okay, I just want to put in, it's not really, the magical machine is not an amplifier. The magical machine is a generator and just increases the generation of the number of photons in a contained area. So they're not amplifying the signal. They're simply generating more photons as you twirl the dial.
AD2DK. To that other gentleman's point, a photon does not necessarily imply light. A photon is the carrier for electromagnetism. So That can be RF that we're talking over right now, or it could be the light from the flashlight on your cell phone, or it could be gamma rays, X-rays, any number of things.
Yeah, that's quite true, John. I mean, I'm the one who said it at red light simply to diminish any kind of questions about frequencies and changing frequencies and what if it was shorter and what if it was longer and what have you. So I kind of introduced the fact of red light as just arbitrary. You could do the same thing with a 40 a meter signal of RF. You could use the same principle with gamma photons. You know, electromagnetism is ultimately electromagnetism, as you mentioned. Yes, Wesley?
Something to the comment. We're only talking about electromagnetic energy, nothing else. And, of course, photons carry on electromagnetic energy. But for the gentleman who was actually making that remark, or anybody else, a question. What is the difference between a photon at frequency of 3.5 megahertz and the photon of frequency 1 nanometer? Answer it here.
AD2DK, are you asking what's the difference between a photon at different frequencies? And of course, that answer would be the amount of energy that it has.
Good. But that's why ultraviolet is dangerous, and anything above that, X-ray, gamma, and whatsoever. Now, when alpha, beta. Dangerous. So air, by dissipating part of that ultraviolet, is actually making us not feeling too much of that ultraviolet problems on our skin. Dr. Roy.
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. Unfortunately, Wesley, some person was kind of tired and couldn't keep his finger off of his push-to-talk button through your conversation, so about 90% of it was not audible. Also, we're coming up to 10:20, and that new ham, KD2ZAN Paul, would really, really like to see if he could reach the repeater. He's very respectful of everyone. He doesn't want to step on anyone. So I thought maybe what we could do for the time being is table this discussion and give Paul KD2ZAN an opportunity to see if he could reach the repeater. Okay?
Okay. I'm going to catch the guy next time.
So, Paul, if you're out there, try again. Oh, well, I guess he's out of range. He's about 15 miles as the crow flies, and he's working on an 8-watt Balfong. And some Balfongs are 8 watts that are rated 8 watts, and some aren't, but oh, well. Paul, if you can hear me, better luck next time. You know where we are every Sunday night at 8 p.m. So please come join us. Take a seat, ask some questions, make some comments, be part of the gang. Just want to thank everyone tonight. There was a lot of interesting participation. I hope everyone learned a bit and had a little bit of fun learning as well. And I thank new participants, John, AD2DK, and more established participants like Mike and Rich and the other John. And thanks to everyone. We're up to our armpits and clever, intelligent people, and I'm happy as the heck about it. So thanks to everyone who participated. Please come back next Sunday when we'll do the TechNet all over again. I'll spare you the links until the very end of the technical net, since it's now 10:23, so it's time for Paul, WS2N, and the SpaceNet report.
Net control, AD2DK, quick question before we digress.
Sure, John.
You allude to a site where there's a live chat. How do I get to that?
You just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that should take you to our little chat room.
Roger that. Got it.
Okie doke. Very good, John. It's been lively the last few weeks, so the more the merrier. So, Paul, please give us the SpaceNet report.
This is WS2N. I have to remember to sign off the chat room. I always forget to do that. Very good. And Wesley, I think it was a microphone problem or something. I recorded it. I could play it back for you sometime. But it's an intermittent problem, I think, at your end. Anyway, let me just say this is Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And what we do is we cover the latest of what's going on with NASA and European Space Agency and the private companies that are coming out of nowhere. I mean, there's one right after the other. And but NASA, of course, is always leading the way as far as I'm concerned. They have just approved another telescope called the SphereX telescope, now apparently funded, and they're going ahead with they've got the design, but now they're going to try to put hardware together for a launch in April 2025. They want to put it at a 130-mile polar orbit. It will be launched on a SpaceX Falcon rocket. Probably from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And this thing is going to receive signals, going to scan the whole sky, signals of infrared. And they're going to be looking for water, ice, that type of thing throughout all the galaxies. It will be scanning 6 months of the sky, you know, when it's at, you know, let's say spring and summer, and then fall and winter, it'll scan the other 6 months of the sky. And it's not a big thing like James Webb Space Telescope, but it does have a big conal type of shield on it, and it will operate in the infrared, but closer to the visual part of it, right? Anyway, what the scientists are looking for is, you know, a map of the whole sky going back, you know, as far as they could look back, they could look all the way back to the beginning of time to try to figure out where all the water ice is. The idea is to, we have water here, we know what water is, and theoretically it's come from comets or asteroids that have hit the Earth. But before that, where did it come from? You know, after the first beginnings of the universe, you know, how did it develop and where did it develop? And does it have anything to do with, you know, the galaxies where they're presently located? Anyway, the scientists love this type of thing, and apparently they've got this Sphere X mission approved spectral photometer for the history of the universe, epoch, and reionization of ICES Explorer. So it's a big long word that basically it's an infrared telescope. So anyway, 2025 they plan on launching this thing. This WS2N. And the space telescope, James Webb Space Telescope, still doing excellent there. They're still working on it. All the mirrors are 100% in line with one another. We're still waiting for the to calibrate the four instruments that will be collecting all these photons. So that will still take another month or two. I guess maybe the end of May we'll get first light, you know, the first pictures coming back from James Webb. But everything went well, you know. It's a $10 billion plus project over 20 years of work, getting it out to the L2 location. All successful, and now they're just working on the final instruments. And as they do that, the instruments are still cooling down. One of the instruments actually has to get down to 6 degrees Kelvin. And under natural conditions, they can't get that far. So they, you know, what went up with this space telescope is a refrigeration unit that works. Actually, they use helium for the refrigerant to get that extra few degrees down that they need to get to 6 degrees Kelvin. For that one instrument, if that thing fails for some reason, the other three instruments will work without the refrigeration device. But they really need to have everything working to call this 100%. So far, everything looks good with James Webb. Let me drop it. Another piece of information that you'll probably see on mainstream news, I'm sure it'll be all over the computer, will be Mark Van der Heil, astronaut with a call sign of KG5GNP. He will be returning March 30th in the morning. I think it's around 6:15 in the morning. He'll be landing in Kazakhstan. So, you know, with all the problems with Russia and everything, it's not stopping the space program. They're still coordinating with Roscosmos. Roscosmos is the Russian version of NASA. And Mark will be coming back after almost a year, about 10 days short of a year in space on the International Space Station. They'll be coming back with two cosmonauts, another cosmonaut that has done the same thing as him, and the other guy, he's been up there about, you know, a few months. So they'll be returning actually in a different Soyuz spacecraft that they went up on. There's a limit on the length of time that the Soyuz could stay docked to the space station. It's around 240 days. So anyway, the one that they went up in has already come back with a different crew. So they'll be actually returning on a different spacecraft that they went on, up on. So that's going to leave behind, right now there's 10 people on board. That will leave behind 10 seven people on a space station. Only for a short period of time, though. You have the Axiom 1 mission going up probably the 3rd or 4th of April. Axiom is a SpaceX Dragon crew mission, but it's a private mission. I brought this up on an F before. It's all commercial. The four people that are going up, you know, are all paying SpaceX, and NASA has approved it for these four to dock with the International Space Station. And they'll dock to the American side, the Harmony forward facing docking adapter. And they'll dock after probably a day and a half, 2 days in space. And they'll spend 10 days on board the International Space Station. It's all private. These four guys are going to do all kinds of science experiments that have all been laid out. Probably a couple of hundred different things that they would like to get accomplished. Three passengers have not flown before, and the commander has. The commander has flown many times, I think. He's done six different flights. But, we'll see what happens after that, because they'll be coming back after 10 days. Right after that, there's going to be another flight going up from Launch Complex 39A, the same launch complex that Axiom 1 will launch from, and that's going to bring up a NASA crew. And they'll be staying for a six-month period. So it's busy. They've got cargo ships coming and going on the International Space Station. Now they have crew vehicles going on, going up and coming back. But we'll cover this as the weeks go by, see how they're doing. The general stay is usually 6 months on the space station, except for the commercial crew. Like I said, they're going to be about 10 days. So, Axiom is a company, relatively new company. They plan on building their own space station. They've already got contracted building a module, large module that's going to attach to the International Space Station probably within 2 years. And then they'll add to that, they plan on two other modules to attach it to that. And the vacuum then plans on bringing up another special module with, it's going to have solar panels and all of that. So you'll have a complete space station really attached to the existing space station. And when you get to about 2030, 2031, whenever NASA decides to start bringing the International Space Station to a close, this new Axiom setup, consisting of basically four different modules, will separate from the space station and be on its own with its own solar panels, crew quarters, and two science labs. Any questions, comments, WS20. March 23rd, they had an EVA on the space station. And what they did was change out two hoses that feed these radiators. There's many different radiators coming out of the International Space Station to get rid of heat. Heat really builds up in either batteries that are being used to keep the space station going, the charging and recharging of those batteries, the heat they have to get rid of is radiated to that, and it's radiated to get rid of the heat inside of the space station. Anyway, one of them was leaking, it's called hoses, and two astronauts, and they happen to both be hams, Roger Chari, KI5LIU, and European Space Agency, Matthias Maya, KI5KFH, he's from Germany. They did a spacewalk to replace those hoses, which worked out okay. They shut the valves down, there's these bail handles that they have to throw, and they shut everything down and eventually replaced them. They call them jumper hoses for now. But apparently that all went well, and they did some other work as well. They needed to change out an old HD camera that had failed. They did that successfully, hook up either cables to it, power cables. That went well. Then when they got these two fellows back into the Quest airlock, they depressurize everything. There's always another astronaut there to help get the helmets off and all. They notice that there's a lot of water inside of Mala's helmet, which is a similar thing that happened back in 2013, a dangerous situation where Louis Palmaro from Italy had the same problem. They actually terminated that EVA because he had so much water inside his helmet. Looks like once in a while these things start to leak. They have water flowing through their spacesuits and all, try to keep them cool when they're in a hot location. And last time they found out, it was clogged and the water was starting to back up. They also have a water system they're able to drink from. They have a tube that they can actually drink water. Sometimes they're out there 6 or 8 hours. So that might be leaking. They don't know yet. But they were kind of surprised to see that. So they'll investigate that and again try to clear that up. Not as bad as the 2013 problem. But still something to look at. See what happens. WS2N, any questions or comments?
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Okay, very good. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu. Go ahead, Rich.
I just wanted to make mention of a Joe Rogan podcast I saw on YouTube. It was with an astronaut who had been up 3 times now. He's from New Jersey. And I forget his name, though. And they were talking about some of the most fascinating subjects, like the astronauts bring up all the hot, spicy sauce they can because food tastes very bland up there. You lose sense of smell and taste up there. And how the Russian food tastes better because it's spicier than all this minutia, which was just fascinating. So I encourage people to look for it. It's a Joe Rogan experience, and I'm sorry, but it's currently playing. I think if you type that into YouTube, it'll come right up. It's just fascinating stuff, Paul. Back to you.
Okay, I'll have to look for that, Rich. Yeah, every Friday, the astronauts, for years now they've been doing this, Friday they all go over to the Russian side, and the Americans, they'll bring food with them from their side, and European Space Agency astronauts, they always have their favorite meals, and they have, like, Friday get together in the Russian module, the main module there. And I've read that in books, in fact, one of the books, Scott Charlie, he also spent almost a year up in space. He includes that the spices, you know, the food, Russian stuff is pretty good, you know, for spices. And they all kind of get used to it. They get used to some of the Russian food. Some of them get shot up in the Soyuz spacecraft. But to do that, they have to train for months on end in Star City in Moscow. And they get used to all the Russian food and, you know, actually on the ground. And sure enough, they bring up some of that with them into the space station. You know, NASA's been dealing with them for decades. I remember in the 90s, we used to send the shuttle to the Mir spacecraft, Russian, you know, before we had an international space station. We used to dock to the Mir space station. There were five shuttle missions that did that. And went to H. Okay, Lou. They would leave our astronauts behind, and you'd have astronauts and cosmonauts on the Mir space station, usually no more than three people. Hi, Lou. Over to you.
Yeah, good evening, Paul. I haven't heard the TechNet. Occasionally, I'm away, so you may have covered this or not, but I'm interested in with what's going on with Russia and Ukraine and how that's affecting the diplomacy of the space station. I did see a video where I guess a new crew came up from Russia, and unless this was a spoof, they were wearing Ukrainian colors, and I don't know how that plays back home. So what do you know about all of this?
Yeah, we covered that quickly last week, but yeah, they had the yellow and blue colors. So, their story is that there's actually three different stories. One, they brought them up for the idea of supporting Ukraine. Then there's another story that, you know, these guys all go to college like we do here, and they all went to the same college, and it just happens that the three guys, they were all Russians, by the way. We didn't have any American on that flight. It has nothing to do with what's going on with Ukraine. That was planned, you know, a year ago. What's happened is, we have the Dragon spacecraft going up to the International Space Station, bringing four people up at a time. We're now bringing our own people up. You know, we still are on the share system where we will bring up one American in a Soyuz spacecraft, usually almost every flight, but except for this one, because now they don't need it. You know, we've had Mark Vanderheil up there for a year. They didn't need to have another American go up on that. But they always like to have an American go up on that. When the shuttle was going, that we would actually bring a Russian up on the shuttle as well. They would share back and forth. And you always need at least one Russian and one American on board the space station at a time. So, that was all planned, that the three guys would be going up there in the first place. So it wasn't like, okay, we cut out an American on this deal. They got there, and they always do a photo shoot of, you know, if a new crew comes up, if it's two people or three people, or now we bring up four at a time with Dragon, they'll go into that module, the main module. In this case, he says the module on the Russian side because it was a Russian launch. If Dragon goes up, they always launch that dock with Harmony, the American side, and they'll always have a group picture inside the Harmony module. But this picture was taken in Zvezda because it was a Russian launch, and sure enough, these three guys have the yellow and blue on. But the college that they came out of in Moscow, I forget the name of it, it happens to be that they had the colors of that particular college. So they think, well, maybe because they were all from the same college. They probably did this. It was planned that way. Nothing to do with Ukraine. And then, of course, the story goes that, well, they smuggled it on board. It was really for them, and they all smuggled these clothes on board at the last minute. They say that's impossible because these clothes are packed like weeks or sometimes a month or two in advance. They're all stored and packed, you know, in the Soyuz orbital module section. There's three sections of Soyuz. It's all packed in there, nice and neat. You know, when they launch, they launch in their spacesuits. In case there's any kind of deep compression, or they have to abort for any reason, they're always in these spacesuits. God forbid a fire. The spacesuits are somewhat fire retarded. But, you know, after they're in orbit, they leave the ascent-descent module that they launch in, and they float into the forward module, called the orbital module. And that's where they change, and they put on these clothes. So it's not clear on what that was. But, yeah, I know that really made the news. Back to you, Lou. NY2HWS.
NY2H, okay, yeah. Yeah, I saw it on the news. All right, so they have a cover story. Interesting. And we'll see how that works out. And again, you may have covered some of this stuff, I don't know, but I just, again, briefly watching the news, I understand that I guess there's an end date now on the particular ISS that's going to go down the ocean somewhere, and that a new one is coming up, and I think Grumman is one of the contenders, if I heard this story right, I don't know, of a, I guess, a modernized space station.
Yeah, Grumman is one of them. It's a, I don't know, looks like three planned space stations. The one I just mentioned was the Axiom. The first crew is going up on the 3rd or 4th of April. And once they have their own space station, they'll be going, you know, they'll have Axiom flights on a regular basis to that space station. But for now, they're bringing the crew there without any module attached, and that module should be attached within 2 years, the first one. Then they'll have two more modules after that, plus another big module that's going to contain solar panels. And that one will break away from the International Space Station. And they'll go on their own after, you know, let's say 2030. NASA's present plan is to end the space station at 2030. I remember years ago they talked about 2024, and I said, no way, it's going to go to 2028. And sure enough, they extended it to 28. Now, last I heard, the Biden administration is going to 2030, and deorbiting would be no earlier than 2031. So, yeah, you have the Axiom system, and then, like you said, you have Northrop Grumman. They plan on sending modules up as well, but they won't connect to the space station. They have, you know, they're thinking about these inflatable modules. They have their own design, along with Sierra Nevada. They have a similar type of design. They have plans, I think they're going to call this Star, I forget the name of it, their own space station. Then there's a big space station that Amazon Jeff Bezos plans on building, called the Reef, R-E-E-F. He plans on sending up two big modules on the second stage. He's building something called the New Glenn rocket, which is almost as big as a Saturn V rocket. You know, it's big, not as powerful, but, you know, it's got to it's going to have a first stage consisting of seven American built by Jeff Bezos. The name of the company is he calls it Blue Origin. to building these 7 engines, and they're called B4 engines. They're going to be methane, liquid oxygen engines. That's what the stage will drop off, and that's going to return to a barge, similar to what SpaceX does out in the ocean, and that will be returned and reused. The second stage won't be reused, and that will deliver the payloads, whatever it might be, to space. But at some point, they want to take that second stage, and that it won't be a second stage. The first stage will put that stage into orbit, and what that will be one massive section of the first part of their orbital reef space station. Then they're going to blast off another one, and that one will attach to it. So that'll be the beginnings of the space station. That was the main plan. Whether or not they keep it that way, I don't know. There's pictures of it. They have all kinds of other companies that will be attaching modules to that. You know, they could add more modules, you know, smaller modules to the sides coming out of the sides of the second stage, you know. By the time they're done, they will be able to handle 10 people on board the orbital reef space station. And they plan on having Sierra Nevada involved, because they plan on having deliveries from Sierra Nevada with their cargo vehicles. They got Boeing definitely involved, because Boeing will be sending crews up in the Starliner. First Starliner should actually launch by the end of this year. That's the plan right now, unless that gets delayed. Starliner is able to bring up 4 astronauts at a time to the International Space Station, and eventually to Orbital Reef. They'll be able to do the same thing, go there with up to 4 people. And hopefully that system gets underway shortly. They have a planned unmanned flight of the Starliner by Boeing in September, and if that works out well, then they'll send the crew up after that. And you might remember back in 2019 in December, they tried to send this Starliner up to the International Space Station to dock, but it never made it. It made it to orbit, but it had all kinds of computer problems, and like a long story short, they ran out of fuel. They ran low on fuel, and they decided to deorbit it. And it successfully landed on land in New Mexico with the Starliner. And next flight was supposed to be a crew. That was a couple of years ago, but delay after delay, they found all the problems with the valves and so on and so forth. They had a major problem that delayed them, and now finally they're able to launch this thing in September. So before you know it, you're going to have, you know, as the years go on, you're going to have a space station by Axiom, you're going to have a space station by Blue Origin, which is really Jeff Bezos and Amazon, and that's called the Reef, and then you're 2 other possible ones, one by Sierra Nevada, if they have plans on these inflatable types of space station, as well as one that you mentioned, Northrop Grumman. They plan on some kind of inflatable type of space station as well, Lou. And Y2HWS2X.
And Y2H. Okay, very good. These deorbiting maneuvers are interesting to me. I wonder, I think I heard on the news there's some spot graveyard in the South Pacific somewhere, and they chose it because it was the furthest from any kind of civilization spot on Earth or something. But still, I guess, I would imagine, they coordinate these deorbiting maneuvers with
obviously aviation, and even maybe maritime. I mean, there's no guarantee that somebody's not going to be there, I guess. So I guess that's how that works. You may mention, talk about that a little bit. And when the Russians blew up their that satellite, which probably did that for military purposes, you know, exercise, there was a lot of space junk generated, and I think it was a problem for the International Space Station there for a while. Has that resolved, or the charting those pieces? I mean, how did that end up also? So two questions there, the deorbiting maneuvers and the space junk.
Yeah, they predicted thousands of pieces of various sizes, all in line with each other, you know, going in constant orbit around the Earth. You know, it didn't spread out like, you know, like a shotgun blast. It shot out like, it spread out like one long line of pieces. And yeah, at one point they did have to, they delayed a spacewalk because they thought one of the pieces was going to get too close to the space station. And then if that happens, they have the capability of maneuvering. They could either speed it up with thrusters, one way to do it, or sometimes they'll actually turn the solar panels face on, you know, like a sail. Even so, you're in space with a vacuum, it's not a perfect vacuum. There's still oxygen molecules and molecules floating around up there. It's very rarefied, but it's enough to actually slow the space station down. In fact, that's what happens. Even under normal conditions, it's the reason the space station always has to be reboosted is because there's little molecules up there. And over time, the space station does start to slow down, and therefore start to lose altitude. So as often as they can, they reboost it. It was great when the shuttle used to go up there. They used to reboost it around 14 miles higher before the shuttle would ever leave, before the shuttle left undocked. They also used to use the ATV, Automatic Transfer Vehicle, from the European Space Agency. That used to, they had five missions that went up there. That would dock to the Russian side of the space station and then push it along. That would do the same thing, bring it up for, 5 or 10 miles every time that thing left. And now they still use the Progress vehicles, the cargo vehicles that the Soyuz brings up. It's called Progress, and that attaches to the space station as well on the Russian side.
It's complete.
And load everything. And but before that, deorbits, they use up most of the fuel to try to push the accelerate the space station. You know, and that's of course by doing that, that's how they actually raise the orbit. And sometimes they buy these thrusters for like a half hour at a time, and then they get on the other side of the Earth and they do the same thing. Like, this way it doesn't become an elliptical orbit. It still stays circular. That's the other thing that they do. That's part of the problem with the Russians and the Americans now. Russians say, well, you need us for propulsion. And we do. It's easier for them to do it, but we can do it. We have the capability. Right now we have a cargo vehicle called Cygnus that's attached to the Unity module on the American side. And the same thing, before that one leaves, this is the first time it's going to do it. That one is going to push the space station into a higher orbit. And that was, again, planned a couple of years ago. Nothing to do with the war. So that was in the plans. Anyway, we still have the capability of doing it. Power, of course, is supplied by mostly by the solar panels that we have up there. And the orientation is also done by the American side. We have control moment gyros, these three gyros that are located in the center of the space station, roughly. And that's what stable. If it starts to drip one way or another, you could turn on the motors surrounding.